And yes, sir, it's another Bathrop Spears Broadside Show. This time it's, coming up on September 28th, 2025. It's a Sunday show, mostly a flashback to December 20th, 1998, but with a few bits and pieces from current events. So stay with me and you'll hear.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you. Sing me of wars and sing me of breadlines. Tell me of front page news. Sing me of strikes and last minute headlines. Dress your observation in syncopation. Sing me a song with social significance. There's nothing else that will do. It must get hot with what is what, or I won't love you.
So let's kick things off with a few stories that I picked out. Had actually intended to bring to the Thursday Huff meeting, except there was no Thursday Huff meeting. I had taken a break, and so did a few other folks, and we were going to meet again. In fact, we do intend to meet again next Thursday, which is going to be October 2nd. But here's a couple stories that interested me, might interest you. Berkeley Homeless Union wins new restraining order delaying encampment closure at 8th and Harrison. The new order is a data point in the legal landscape of encampment closures post Grants Pass. Grants Pass being the decision that overturned Martin versus Boise, which said homeless people have the right to sleep, camp, survive. And not be harassed by police if there's no other accommodations available and there's no other problems involved with the campsite. That was overturned by Grants Pass in a case reportedly forwarded in large part by pressure from people like Gavin Newsom, who wanted to give cities more opportunity to kick homeless people out. And presumably encourage cities to provide shelter. But cities in the past have not shown that actually has that effect. It's easier for them to pretend that police activity will simply resolve everything, even though it doesn't. It simply makes things harder for homeless people and harder for the police, in my view. Anyway, story continues. It's September 4th, 2025, by Robbie Powelson, who's in my book, a famous do-it-yourself homeless activist. First came to my attention with his work with the Sausalito Anchorouts, when he helped to support them for a period of time and showed them how to write their own restraining orders and temporary TROs and so forth. Here's the story, though. On August 10th, a federal judge, Edward Chen, extended a restraining order preventing the city of Berkeley from removing Berkeley Homeless Union members, BHU members, from their encampment at 8th and Harrison Streets. The extension of the restraining order came after the judge determined that the city was not following a requirement to engage in an interactive process to determine whether BHU members, Berkeley Homeless Union members, were eligible for disability-related modifications under the Americans with Disability Act, the ADA. The new restraining order follows a string of recent legal actions related to the closure of the encampment. Last month, BHU filed an emergency motion to hold the city in contempt for violating a June 10th injunction by the court, which had barred the closure of the camp until the city completed an interactive process to identify disability accommodations. Before that, the court had issued successive temporary restraining orders on behalf of BHU members who live in the encampment in February and in June. The interactive process is a federally mandated procedure under the ADA. It requires governments to adopt reasonable modifications to accommodate disabilities. The June 10th injunction had been set to expire on August 10th after the ADA process was expected to be complete. I helped the BHU's motion for contempt, and I participated in the interactive process as a representative of the California Homeless Union, which is providing legal support to BHU in this case, I being Robbie Pallison, the author of this article. The recent emergency restraining order was granted to BHU members after the group argued that Berkeley Deputy City Attorney Iris Mattis shut down the in-person meetings that were part of the required interactive ADA process. Mattis says she shut down the in-person meetings because a BHU member threatened her during an earlier meeting, claiming the woman said, why don't I take you out there with me and put you in the water and you commit suicide with me? Mattis alleged that this meant that the woman was threatening to drown her and make it seem as though she had committed suicide. The woman, however, denied threatening Mattis. In a filing, the woman gave her side of the story. Her statement was, "Throughout the meeting, I listened and sat composed at the table. But at the end, after hearing nothing but denials from city staff and language that suggested for me, quote, to remove myself from the Harrison corridor, like if I was garbage, I felt desperation. When I said to Iris Mattis, why don't I take you out there with me and put you in the water and you commit suicide with me, I was not threatening anyone. I was trying to explain how hopeless I felt in this situation. It's sink or swim, and I feel like I am drowning in despair. I felt invisible and discarded by the city, and I needed them to understand how serious this is for me." Robbie Pallison's story continues. "I was present at a number of the interactive ADA meetings as an advocate to assist BHU members in the process. The meetings were hours long with unhoused BHU, Berkeley Homeless Union members, and city officials sitting on opposite sides of the table going through long lists of possible accommodations for the planned sweep at 8th and Harrison. The experience was often grueling, with BHU members and officers proposing modification after modification to accommodate their disabilities, and city officials refusing these proposals, saying the requests were, quote, outside the scope, unquote, of the city programs. During the 8-week process, the city did not accept a single modification requested by the BHU. Unable to find common ground, the tension in the room culminated in the alleged threat to Mattis as the unhoused member of the BHU expressed the pain and suffering she felt the city was inflicting upon her. After another similarly tense meeting, Mattis canceled all future meetings, citing concern that BHU members were unable to promise that she would not receive threats moving forward. Mattis also did not identify alternate locations for encampment residents, even though she previously assured the court that alternative city-owned properties where camping would not be permitted could be found. Federal Judge Edward Chen expressed anger and frustration at the city's refusal to identify alternate sites, at times raising his voice at city attorneys during the hearing on August 10th. Instead of ruling on contempt, Judge Chen ordered the parties to negotiate the ADA claims with Magistrate Judge Robert Illman. Until then, the city remains barred from closing BHU or clearing BHU members from the encampment at 8th and Harrison. The parties are now ordered to meet with Magistrate Judge Illman to address the ADA claims and conditions at 8th and Harrison. The timeline for the end of the preliminary injunction is uncertain, and until then, BHU members may remain in the encampment. The case reflects a wide variation in application of the ADA in homeless litigation since the Grants Pass ruling in the Supreme Court last year. The BHU case represents the first long-term restraining order in the United States preventing an encampment eviction under the ADA since the Grants Pass ruling ended the Eighth Amendment protections for unhoused people under the U.S. Constitution. While the BHU's success with finding protection for unhoused plaintiffs using the ADA represents a significant victory, other courts are ruling differently. In a different case I'm involved in, a federal judge in Marin County denied a preliminary injunction under the ADA for a small encampment in Fairfax at Schwartz versus Town of Fairfax. Fairfax is a small community in Marin County, somewhat northwest of San Rafael, if you know Marin County. That case was argued under a similar legal theory to the one in Berkeley, but the desired restraining order was denied on August 20th. Similarly, in July, another court in Berkeley denied a restraining order on similar grounds for the encampment at Ohlone Park. These disparate rulings portray the high standards and fact-specific determinations courts are placing on unhoused litigants looking for legal protections post-Grants Pass. That's Robbie Pallison. Berkeley Homeless Union wins new restraining order delaying encampment closure at 8th and Harrison. However, it's not all good news because a September 15th story 2 weeks later and several weeks ago in the Berkeley Scanner by Emily Raguzzo says Berkeley can clear a small part of the homeless camp, judge says. The city can clean up part of the Harrison Corridor encampment but must leave 8 homeless individuals on their property alone if they are there. After a months-long court battle, a federal judge has granted the city of Berkeley permission to clean up one side of one block of the long-standing Harrison Corridor homeless encampment. In court papers, the city described conditions in the area as shocking, writing, "One is forced to walk down the middle of the street because the sidewalks are crowded with debris. The residents, patrons, and employees in this area are essentially imprisoned by the encampment." The city wrote that the increasingly dire conditions, quote unquote, are present throughout the corridor, but said it hoped to clear the east side of 8th Street between Harrison Street and Cotteronices Creek because community members in that location, including those associated with the Berkeley Repertory Theater, which has property there, are facing imminent harm if no action is taken. Over the past 3 years, the city wrote, Berkeley Rep and its employees have endured significant adverse impacts due to the presence of homeless encampments, including harassment from encampment residents, vandalism, rat infestations, human waste, and garbage being thrown or dumped onto the property, and even gunfire directed at their building. In his ruling, Judge Edward Chen said Berkeley can clean up part of the block, but must leave 8 homeless individuals on their property alone if they are camped there. Those residents who have previously been identified in the court process as those requiring ADA accommodations shall not be moved pending further order of the court, Chen wrote Friday, a couple Fridays ago. In February, the Berkeley Homeless Union sued the city on behalf of a group of disabled and unhoused residents, citing constitutional due process violations in relation to a planned city cleanup at the Harrison Corridor homeless encampment. The city's removal of the camp has been stalled ever since, pending the ongoing court process. In June, Judge Chen said Berkeley could abate parts of the Harrison Street encampment as long as it provided a week's notice and left the residents from the ADA lawsuit alone as negotiations continued. But exactly where the work will end remains unclear. In Friday's order, Chen wrote that the Berkeley Homeless Union can seek to add more people beyond the 8 that Berkeley concedes are protected by the preliminary injunction to the list for ADA considerations, with a ruling by the court on that matter expected in October. In the coming weeks, both sides are set to continue discussing the rules for negotiations over ADA accommodations, including whether they must happen in person or can take place online or by phone. Chen wrote that the current round of ADA negotiations must be completed by October 31st. By that date, the parties shall file a joint statement identifying the status of the interactive process and each party's last and best position regarding accommodations for each of the eight individuals, he wrote. Last week, a different judge who had been overseeing settlement discussions between the city and the Berkeley Homeless Union washed his hands of the case for now and turned it back to Judge Chen, citing a complete breakdown in settlement discussions. He said he would consider picking up negotiations at a future date, but only if both sides agree. The city's half-block cleanup on 8th Street could happen this week. And of course, the story here, which is in a publication called the Berkeley Scanner, which I'm unfamiliar with, by Emily Raguzzo, does not give any mention of the failure, the breakdown in the negotiations over the ADA accommodations. That is to say, if you're going to be removing someone's encampment and people, it's going to cause them a serious jeopardy because they have no place to go or because the city has made it illegal everywhere. You have to accommodate that in some way, either by providing shelter or some other way. And the deputy city attorney, Iris Matthews, according to the story by Powelson, was simply not willing to do that. She claimed that the despair expressed by one of the Berkeley Homeless Union members at the failure of the city to accept any of the proposed accommodations, although it's interesting that none of the accommodations are mentioned either way in either story, made her so desperate and made so alarmed the Berkeley deputy city attorney that she felt for her safety, which I suppose bourgeois people can feel that way about folks on the street just by looking at them, in the same way that apparently Jewish supremacists in Israel can feel horror, hatred, fear, or contempt for Palestinians in Gaza. I suppose that's not necessarily the fairest thing to say about this process, except if you've observed how city officials treat homeless people in other cities, it's not such a big leap.
Civilization has been challenged from the start. With all these people, things can fall apart. Ideas can spread by many different means. Whispered words on TV screens. Alarming news wherever you go. Angry people talking on the radio. For a long time now, we've had a big mess ever since the invention of the printing press. Folks have been spreading disinformation about everything you could imagine. Stories of people, what they might have done. Stories of lines to buy ammo for guns. Wasn't Big Brother a bad enough situation for us to have to add to the equation? Algorithms skewing everything you take in. Personalized to everywhere you have been. Creating a world where we each can be. Living in our own reality. By AI, You're the target, that's clearly true, but nobody else can tell but you. Making money while you are not doing anything other than chatting with bots. What we see now in real time is a whole new level of corporate crime. Something the world has never seen. The rumor mill and the propaganda machine, together like never seen before. What in the world might be in store? Civilization has been challenged from the start.
And that was a relatively new song by David Rovix, at least I hadn't heard it before, called Invisible Rulers. Now back to the Berkeley Scanner, this online publication, and another article, earlier one, by Emilie Raguso, and it's entitled Berkeley Can't Close Harrison Homeless Camp Yet, Judge Says, from June 10th, some months back. But it's got a lot more details, and I'm going to read a bit of it. The city must give campers, quote, fair warning of at least a week before taking enforcement action on Harrison Street again, said Judge Edward Chen. Citing concerns about disabilities, a federal judge has ordered the city of Berkeley to negotiate over the next 2 months with some residents of the Harrison Street homeless camp before it can clear the area for good. In his ruling Tuesday, Judge Edward Chen said the city must engage with up to 19 people who filed Americans with Disabilities Act claims seeking accommodations to help them leave the encampment or potentially stay indefinitely. Going forward, Chen said campers who have not filed ADA claims must be given fair warning of at least 1 week before the city takes enforcement action on Harrison Street again, quote, given everything that's happened, unquote. The judge said those individuals would no longer be subject to the protection of this court and that the limited injunction that I'm now issuing will not apply to them. Last week, Chen ordered Berkeley to stop breaking up the Harrison Street camp, saying it had not given the encampment residents adequate notice. And I may look at that story too, but let's continue with this one. How and when the city's abatement work could continue was set to be decided Tuesday morning. The Berkeley Homeless Union, with support from attorney Anthony Prince of the California Homeless Union, had asked for an injunction to protect the camp going forward. On Tuesday, the judge said Berkeley had made a fairly substantial showing in its filings about the types of problems in the Harrison Corridor since the encampment started. But, he said, the camp also provides some stability and access to services beyond what its residents might get if they were dispersed. Tuesday morning, Prince said about a dozen of the 19 or so people at the Harrison Street encampment now had previously filed ADA claims related to physical or psychiatric disabilities. The law requires the city to offer reasonable accommodations to each of them if their disability makes it harder to leave the camp. But exactly what those accommodations are remains an open question. Iris Matties, a deputy city attorney for the city of Berkeley, said her office had, quote, been engaging in ADA accommodation requests for over 5 months. Some of the accommodations, such as help with packing or more time to comply with leaving, have been easier to grant than others, including a request for a personal wheelchair, which cities are not required to provide. Mattis said, some people had asked to stay indefinitely or be placed in housing, which the city said fell outside the scope of its duties and the law. Judge Chen noted that in his view, those individuals would have a very difficult claim to make under the ADA. Mattis said the staff had responded to each of the ADA requests, but that efforts had stalled in some cases when campers stopped responding or failed to document their claims. We will say no, and the same request will be repeated over and over again, or there will be delays of weeks or months, he said, It feels like it may be sort of never-ending. We've always held the door, opened the door for further requests or accommodations because it's interactive and it's iterative, Mattis continued. It's hard to say that something is finalized because we keep the door open for any last-minute request. In his ruling, which came after more than an hour of legal arguments, Judge Chen said the individuals with ADA claims are legally entitled to complete the interactive process before the city takes place. Chen said Berkeley had failed to show the work had concluded. The judge ordered the city to report back within 60 days, at which point he would decide whether to lift the injunction on Harrison Street based on whether he felt the process was complete. Chen said he would look closely at whether the parties had negotiated in good faith, including if they had been willing to bend. On that point, the judge dinged the city for blocking requests by some individuals who had asked to record their sessions with the city's ADA coordinator, saying he didn't see why Berkeley should refuse. He said he also expected those making ADA claims to be able to show a reasonable nexus between their disability and the requested accommodation. Chen went on to say that his colleague on the bench, Judge Robert Illman, had offered to serve as a mediator if there were individual disputes over reasonable accommodation interactive process. Prince, attorney for the California Homeless Union, noted that Illman had been instrumental in helping both sides reach agreement in other encampment cases he'd been on, resulting in a positive settlement. Prince asked Judge Chen if he might consider expanding his order to require broader negotiations before Judge Illman between the plaintiff and the city. You can't order the parties to settle, Prince said, but the court does have the authority to order the parties to sit down and see if a settlement could be worked out. Chen said he would only make that order if both sides were in agreement. If the parties want to do that, I certainly welcome that. I would recruit him, Chen said, but he had already accepted the limited assignment. And I believe we learned he quit because he felt the process was going nowhere, or it said he washed his hands of it. Again, a lot of the specifics seem to be on the side of the city, rather city officials, rather than on the side of the disabled homeless encampment folks. So again, going further back, another story by Raguso from June 4th, about a week or two before that story I just read. Judge orders Berkeley to stop Harrison encampment cleanup, gives us a few more details about at least some of the history of the situation. The city's abatement shall cease immediately, U.S. District Judge Edward Chen wrote Wednesday afternoon. A federal judge has ordered the city of Berkeley to stop the removal of a longstanding homeless encampment on Harrison Street until at least next week. The city's abatement shall cease immediately until further order, U.S. District Judge Edward Chen wrote Wednesday afternoon. The next court hearing on the encampment is set for Tuesday, June 10th. The city of Berkeley began removing the Harrison Street encampment early Wednesday morning, citing serious problems such as rats and feces, rotting food, hypodermic needles, and combustible materials. We want safety for all, both the unhoused and the housed, city spokesman Mathe Chaco said Wednesday afternoon, and the conditions here were not good for anyone. Now, of course, when this happened at the Ross Camp 6 years ago in 2019, the Ross Camp had agreed a camp set up right outside what was Ross's department store, and I guess now is the new New Leaf store, which is sort of at the intersection of Highway 1 and Highway 9. There was no assistance, although it was promised, to the people encamped at the Ross Camp, and they were willing to do the cleanup and to make the changes that were required to clean things up, provided the city could provide them advice and help and guidelines. The city promised to do that, but then essentially went back on its word, and it became clear the city was not acting in good faith. At least that's the way I saw it. And I suspect, well, with my experience in Santa Cruz, and the city of Berkeley may be acting in a similar way. including city spokesman Amathe Chaco. Chaco said about a dozen people who were staying in the area were told to leave. City staff were on hand to help them pack their belongings, he said. Berkeley police were also part of the operation, which took place on Harrison Street between 8th and 10th Streets in Northwest Berkeley. One man who initially left the area was arrested after returning to the block, Chaco said. At some point, attorney Anthony Prince filed an emergency request on behalf of the Berkeley Homeless Union to stop removal of the encampment, according to court papers. Prince wrote that he had learned about the cleanup at 9:30 a.m. after the city showed up with bulldozers and was ordering everyone to leave in 20 minutes. According to his declaration, he called Mark Schaap, Berkeley's deputy city attorney, to ask for an explanation and insisted he call off the action. He refused to do so, Prince wrote. In the filing in which Prince misstated the encampment location as well as the date, he asked the court to stop the city from clearing the camp, citing a hearing already scheduled for next week. In response, the city asked a judge to reject Prince's request, describing it as, quote, procedurally improper and substantively deficient. In its filing, the city wrote an earlier order blocking it from taking action on Harrison Street had expired May 23rd. The city also argued that Prince had missed a deadline Monday and called his motion improper. But at least for now, Judge Chen did not appear to have been convinced. He wrote that an explanatory order about his emergency ruling would be forthcoming. Earlier in the day, Chaco, the city spokesman, said Berkeley had focused a tremendous amount of attention on the Harrison Street corridor dating back to at least 2021, offering housing and services to many unsheltered residents in the area. From September 2021 through December 2024, the city made nearly 740 shelter offers, with more than 20% going to people in the Harrison Street corridor. Or so says our writer here, but doesn't give her source. Over the same period, the city carried out approximately 18 encampment operations throughout Berkeley, both deep cleanings as well as closures, he said, with more than 20% happening in the Harrison Street corridor. The city also used a $5 million grant from the state, Chaco said, to master lease the campus motel on University Avenue, formerly a Super 8, to help house unsheltered people who had stayed in the encampment. According to current estimates, Berkeley has more than 400 unsheltered homeless people who sleep on city streets and city parks and elsewhere in the community. Harrison Street Homeless Camp, a troubled history. On Wednesday, Chaco explained the conditions in the Harrison Street encampment were not reflective of what we are seeing elsewhere. What's been happening here is not reflective of the unhoused population as a whole. In October 2022, the city did, quote, a large scale cleanup in the area after declaring an imminent health hazard on and around the Harrison Street homeless encampment. In May 2023, the next year, the city pledged to address serious ongoing public safety issues in the neighborhood, but little seemed to change. Last year in January, a homeless shelter survived a shooting on Harrison Street west of 4th Street. Then in June, a man tried to set a woman on fire outside her RV on Harrison Street, according to police. That same month, Berkeley Fire Department put out an encampment fire at 8th and Harrison that created a heavy column of black smoke visible for miles. In August, a resident was killed by his bunkmate in a shooting at the same homeless shelter where a shelter worker was shot in January. In September 2024, city officials said Berkeley needed to get more aggressive in its approach to problematic camps, adopting a resolution to allow stepped-up enforcement amid hazardous conditions, and citing Harrison Street as one example. I'm reading all this and kind of presenting the city's side of it, but it's one side of it, I'm afraid. Not that I know anything about this particular encampment. The same week, 9 businesses and property owners in the area of the Harrison Street encampment filed a lawsuit demanding action. Problems continued this year. In January, a woman died in a tent fire at 5th and Harrison Streets. In early March, police said a homeless camp resident used a metal broom handle in an unprovoked attack near 7th and Harrison Street. In May, a man was charged with multiple felonies after attacking two people and threatening to kill them on 8th Street north of Harrison, according to court papers. In the same month, there was an RV fire on 7th Street south of Gilman Street, not far away. The city has held two large community meetings this year to address concerns at other Berkeley homeless encampment in Civic Center Park, now cleared, and Ohlone Park, where a recent city cleanup was stalled by a new legal action by the Berkeley Homeless Union, but that eventually, I think, failed and the Ohlone Park got mowed down by the city authorities. During the community meetings, the city said much of its work in Northwest Berkeley had paid off. And while much of the public comment at these meetings came from residents and business owners concerned about worsening conditions, advocates and activists have decried city sweeps. They say simply push problems from block to block, separate unhoused individuals from critical property, and break up community bonds and support. In February, the Berkeley Homeless Union filed its original lawsuit against the city, seeking a temporary restraining order to block enforcement on Harrison Street, which the judge ultimately granted. Plaintiffs are disabled individuals who rely on their tents and encampment setups for safety, shelter, community, and essential accommodations, and the removal of these will likely lead to the rapid deterioration of their physical and mental health, they wrote in the February filing. Many residents, due to physical disabilities and mental disabilities, lack the ability to pack their belongings or move their possessions without assistance, putting them at risk of losing critical items such as medications, identification, and mobility aids. On Wednesday, the Berkeley Homeless Union did not respond to requests for comment. And that's judge orders Berkeley to stop Harrison encampment cleanup, as well as a sort of a sympathetic to the cleanup people who want the things, quote, cleaned up, description of the history of all the incidents and bad things that have happened around this particular encampment. Perhaps I'll be able to give some of the other side of the story if I can talk to any of the people or find them, assuming they're still around Harrison and 8th or somewhere in the city that where they can be found. I go up to Berkeley on usually about at least once a month to pick up Street Spirit and Street Sheet newspapers for folks to sell. So if you're interested in that, the results of that, if I have any conversations up there, you can listen to the show or you can check out the Huff meeting. Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom is still slated to meet. I guess we're still slated to meet every Thursday. That's from 1:30 to 3:30, and it's right next to the bike church at the Sub Rosa Cafe.
From Bangladesh and Belgium, Qatar and Korea, from Australia and Austria they went. Gathered in the ports and set sail to the place abandoned by the world's governments. 500 people from 50 different countries, from Mexico, Sweden, and Tunisia. They set sail from around the world to lay all their love on Gaza. As I sing this now, at the end of September, who knows where they might be by tomorrow? As a million children in Gaza starve with no time left to borrow. On the boats they say it's not about us, as the drones are bombing the flotilla. They set sail from around the world to lay all their love on Gaza. The tons of aid the boats are carrying may be said to be only a token, but you've got to do something when everything else has been completely bombed and broken. From Spain and Slovenia, Oman and Malaysia, the US and Canada, Denmark and Estonia, they set sail from around the world to lay all their love on Gaza. As we watch this unfold now in real time, is there a state that might react? They they could send their navy to international waters according to legal fact. Because from Italy, Indonesia, Greece, and Germany, Switzerland, Iceland, and Colombia, they set sail from around the world to lay all their love on Gaza. The Israelis jammed the radios with an ABBA song, "Lay All Your Love on Me." Psychological warfare in the middle of the Mediterranean Sea. The next chapter isn't written, but from Japan, Turkey, and Libya, they set sail from around the world to lay all their love on Gaza. They set sail from around the world to lay all their love on Gaza.
And that, of course, was another one by David Rovix called Lay Your Love on Gaza. So positive stories about encampments holding their own are not many. They're few and far between, but Vallejo has one. I'm going to read you from a couple of articles about Vallejo. Rather than using the start at the beginning and head back, I'm sorry, start at the end and begin back as it go back to the beginning, I'm going to try to start at an earlier point and then get back to where we're at currently. Here's a story by Ryan Geller about a year ago, September 4th, 2024. Vallejo homeless union members file federal lawsuit to stop encampment eviction. They allege that Vallejo and Caltrans improperly confiscate possessions and vehicles used for shelter. A group of homeless Vallejo residents filed a federal lawsuit against the city of Vallejo and Caltrans on Friday, alleging that the agencies and their representatives improperly confiscate possessions and vehicles used for shelter. The members of the Vallejo chapter of the National Union of the Homeless are seeking an injunction to prevent the city from removing their vehicles and belongings from a secluded parking lot next to an abandoned building on Mary Island. The residents of the camp said that they have nowhere else to go after being told to leave one location after another. This small community that we have is a safe place. It is a place we call home. Nobody gets hungry here, and nobody is afraid, encampment member Lisa Amarant, 61, wrote in the lawsuit. It's a very amazing little place. We just want to live, and we don't try and bother anyone and try hard to take care of our own. With no notice, we risk losing each other and the safety that we have. Assistant to the city manager, Natalie Peterson, arrived at the camp on August 27th, accompanied by four police cars and eight officers, to tell the group that they had to leave by August 30th, according to encampment resident Robert Topfer. Members of the group said they felt they were under imminent threat of losing their shelter, so they filled out legal forms to request a court order to prevent the city from towing their RVs and trailers. Lawyers who provide legal assistance to chapters of the National Union of the Homeless provided the group with some guidance on which forms to fill out, but members of the camp drafted the complaint and filed the documents without legal representation. City Manager Andrew Murray said in a statement that the city empathizes with the challenges faced by unhoused individuals and is actively developing additional affordable housing units in Vallejo. In the meantime, they can just sit out there in the cold and or in the heat and deal with their problems. Oh, well, that's my little addition to this. To be developing additional housing units, but to be attempting to clear people before you have them is clearly a form of... It's both cruelty and hypocrisy, in my view. Anyway, the manager said the city has no comment relating to active litigation cases. The city currently has two projects under construction that are intended to serve homeless residents. The 47-unit Broadway Supportive Housing Project, which faced fiscal challenges earlier in the year, and the long-delayed Navigation Center that will provide 125 shelter beds and an access point for a range of services. Both projects are expected to be complete by the end of the year. There are many more of these evictions happening, said retired civil rights attorney Ocean Newman, who successfully sued Caltrans on behalf of homeless people in Oakland and Berkeley who had their possessions destroyed. And there are legal bases to challenge them, but the number of lawyers available to file a complaint and the required documents for them is not sufficient. Newman is not involved in the case, but he reviewed the documents for an interview with the Vallejo Sun. He said the complaint does not meet the formal requirements because it does not include causes of action or facts showing why what the city wants to do would violate the listed constitutional amendments and laws. However, he said that the personal accounts in the complaints do touch on issues that are constitutionally protected, such as Fourth Amendment protections against unreasonable search and seizure, and the 14th Amendment protection from citizens from being placed in danger created by the state. Several of the plaintiffs also said they are disabled, and the city is required to provide accommodations for persons with disabilities, such as by providing more time or assistance if they are required to move, said Newman. The legal claims suggested in the lawsuit are not affected by the recent U.S. Supreme Court ruling, that's Martin versus Boise, overturned by the Grants Pass versus Johnson ruling, that Eighth Amendment protections against cruel and unusual punishment do not bar cities and counties from enforcing prohibitions against camping, even when no local shelter space is available. Plaintiffs that litigate a case without legal representation are often allowed some leeway in regard to legal procedures. Newman said that even though the complaint does not assert the claims in a formal manner, a judge may be sympathetic to the issues described in the personal statements and grant a hearing on whether to issue a temporary restraining order. The personal accounts in the lawsuit detail a series of encampment closures stretching back to the spring of 2023 that have left houseless residents with fewer and fewer options for a safe place to camp. Several of the plaintiffs described being evicted from Lemon and Dare Street, then moving to the Vallejo boat launch, which city officials also cleared, and then returning to Lemon and Dare, which swelled with campers facing limited options. After police towed a number of vehicles from Lemon and Dare Streets at the end of July, that was July of last year, and finally closed the camp in August of last year by placing concrete barriers along the streets, some residents of the camp moved to a location on Mare Island, or Mary Island, but it's M-A-R-E, whatever the pronunciation, near Highway 37. The group was hoping to form a camp with rules to support working people and protect elders and those with disabilities. A few weeks after the group moved to the new spot, Caltrans reps and California Highway Patrol officers told the members of the camp that they had to leave within 24 hours. Several of the plaintiffs noted the difficulty in moving their belongings in the limited time frame, and some reported losing important items as a result. A couple members of the group searched for a new spot and found what they felt was an out-of-the-way location at 505 Azuar Street, an abandoned building at 505 and Azuar Street. The plaintiffs in the lawsuit are all members of the Vallejo Homeless Union, which was established by Vallejo homeless residents in July. The newly formed union has sent notices to city officials that they wish to be included in discussions on addressing homelessness so they can provide expertise and input on policy issues which affect their membership. The Vallejo Union is a local chapter of the National Union of the Homeless, which was originally formed in the late 1980s and then saw renewed interest from organizers in 2019. The national organization offers training, resources, and legal support to local chapters that are active in 11 states. It's been kind of inactive in Santa Cruz, but not always. Peterson, the city attorney, I guess, or city manager, one of the two, initially agreed to meet with the union in a July 5th email, but union members received no response to follow-up emails to set a date. The broader membership of the homeless union has discussed working with the city to establish a model encampment at the fairgrounds or other locations, according to 505 Azuar residents, and hope that their efforts to maintain the property will show that they can responsibly manage the site, but they are relying on the lawsuit to stop the city from removing their vehicles in the near term. And that was Ryan Geller's article from September 4th, 2024, Vallejo Homeless Union Members File Federal Lawsuit to Stop Encampment Eviction. And about 9 months later, Marissa Kendall wrote an article, First of Its Kind Court Order Halt Sweep of California Homeless Camp, March 5th, 2025. This appears to be the first such injunction since the U.S. Supreme Court let cities crack down on homeless encampments in California and beyond. The Bay Area city of Vallejo is putting California city's newfound power to clear homeless encampments to the test. A federal judge last month stopped the city from dismantling the makeshift shelter of 64-year-old Evelyn Alfred, which she erected nearly 2 years ago on an empty strip of land next to a residential neighborhood. The ruling proves that even as more cities in California crack down on encampments with sweeps and criminal charges, there are pathways open for unhoused people to fight back. I think now what this shows is that there is hope, said Andrea Henson, an attorney who represents Alfred and also leads the Berkeley-based nonprofit aid organization, Where Do We Go? Before the U.S. Supreme Court ruled last summer in a case out of Grants Pass, Oregon, Alfred's win might not have been a big deal. Back then, legal precedent said it was cruel and unusual to punish people for sleeping outside if they had nowhere else to go. As a result, cities had to be careful to offer shelter before clearing a camp. If they didn't, a judge might very well step in and stop the sweep. That all changed in June of last year, when the court caused a dramatic shift by finding, in Grants Pass versus Johnson, that cities can ban people from setting up homeless encampments, even if there are no shelter beds available. The recent order stopped Vallejo from clearing Alfred's camp appears to be the first such legal injunction since the Grants Pass decision, according to several legal experts interviewed by CalMatters. Cities and other governmental entities have been using the Grants Pass decision as if it was a green light to clear encampments, said Anthony Prince, one of the attorneys representing Alfred. This ruling, he says, proves that thinking is wrong. Representatives from the city of Vallejo did not respond to CalMatters' interview requests. Many city leaders, and even California's Democratic governor, Gavin Newsom, had cheered the Supreme Court decision, assuming it would give local governments freedom to remove camps that had taken over sidewalks, city parks, and other public spaces. Advocates for the rights of unhoused people were appalled, worried cities would now indiscriminately criminalize people just for being homeless. But this recent Vallejo case shows it's not so simple. As a result, legal experts and other attorneys who represent homeless plaintiffs throughout the state are paying attention to Alfred's fight to stay put. I think we're all watching closely to see what the courts will do, said Ron Hochbaum, a law professor and director of the Bucola Family Homeless Advocacy Clinic at the University of the Pacific. Evelyn Alfred's court battle. The dwelling Alfred is fighting to keep is made out of tarps, wood, and other materials, and has a roof, windows, and a locking door, according to court documents. Her lawyers argued it's the only thing that protects Alfred, who walks with a cane and wears a back brace due to her osteoarthritis and other medical conditions, from the elements. The city of Vallejo first informed Alfred of its intent to remove her camp in October, and Alfred sued shortly after. In November, a federal judge temporarily blocked the city from clearing Alfred's camp by issuing a temporary restraining order, an order that lasts until the court holds a hearing on the issue. In February, the court granted a preliminary injunction, which is a much bigger win. It lasts longer and comes only after both sides have made extensive arguments in court and the judge has had ample time to deliberate. This appears to be the first one issued in federal court since Grant's pass. It means Alfred can stay put until her case settles or goes to trial. Alfred is on several wait lists for affordable housing, but hasn't yet been offered a placement, according to her lawyers. When she asked where she could go if she were to leave her campsite, the city's attorney said she could not camp anywhere else in Vallejo, according to court documents. The city does not provide shelter or transitional housing. Therefore, Alfred's lawyers argued, she would be put in harm's way if she were forced to leave her camp, especially due to her age, physical and mental disabilities, and as a woman, her vulnerability to sexual assault. U.S. District Judge Dena Coggins sided with Alfred. Removing plaintiff's shelter while knowing plaintiff has no alternatives is likely to expose her to more dangerous conditions than she currently faces by depriving her of protection from the elements, hygiene facilities, and access to life essentials, creating a known and particularized danger to plaintiff's safety and welfare, she wrote. If the city knowingly puts Alfred in danger, that would violate her right to due process under the 14th Amendment, Coggins wrote. The city, on the other hand, argued that it should be allowed to remove Alfred's camp because the camp presents health hazards caused by human waste, her makeshift dwelling violates multiple building codes, and in erecting the dwelling, she damaged a city-owned fence. Plaintiff has been properly noticed and provided with additional time to remove her encampment, attorneys for the city wrote in a court filing. The city must now be allowed to enforce its law and remove plaintiff's encampment. But Coggins found no proof that Alfred's camp presented any weighty health and safety concerns. Now the case will continue on toward a trial or a settlement. The city has filed a motion to dismiss, which Coggins is scheduled to hear in May. What does this mean for future homeless plaintiffs? Before 2018, homeless plaintiffs often used the 14th Amendment, the basis for Alfred's win, and the 4th Amendment, which protects against unreasonable searches and seizures by the government, to challenge encampment sweeps in court. Then the federal Ninth Circuit Appellate Court ruled in Martin v. Boise that punishing unhoused people for camping in public if they have nowhere else to go violates the Eighth Amendment's ban on cruel and unusual punishment. After that, the Eighth Amendment became the weapon of choice for lawyers representing unhoused people. And it got results. In 2022, lawyers using the Eighth Amendment to sue San Francisco won a major victory, an order that stopped the city from enforcing several anti-camping laws as long as there weren't enough shelter beds available. Then, last summer, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that Grant's Pass was not engaging in cruel and unusual punishment by banning encampments despite a lack of shelter beds. Suddenly, the Eighth Amendment was off the table. Now, homeless plaintiffs and the lawyers who represent them are turning to other strategies. The Vallejo case proves that those can still work, even as cities throughout California ban encampments. Alfred's attorneys also claim the city of Vallejo violated the Americans with Disabilities Act by failing to accommodate Alfred's disabilities as it tried to clear her camp. Coggins disagreed because the city granted Alfred more time to move and granted her request for help packing her belongings. I think we're all watching closely to see what the courts will do, said Ron Hochbaum, law professor at the University of the Pacific. But legal experts in Disabilities Act claims are likely to pop up in future cases. Legal experts as today said that those claims were likely to pop up. In a 2023 survey of homeless Californians, 1 in 5 said they used a cane, walker, wheelchair, or other mobility aid, according to UCSF Benioff Homelessness and Housing Initiative. Survey participants also reported that shelters and subsidized housing weren't accessible. That's certainly an issue, said Laura Riley, a social justice attorney and law prof at UC Berkeley. We know that people who are unhoused disproportionately have disabilities. The plaintiff in this case has multiple disabilities, both mobility and mental health disabilities, so making sure that they honor the protections of the ADA for the unhoused population is important, and we know that's not happening, especially during sweeps. And that again, I think I have all of it. Is first of its kind court order, halt sweep of California homeless camp, by Marissa Kendall, March 5th, 2025. And finally, we have a story by Robbie Powelson, which I may have read on this show, but I'm not sure. But in any case, this is the most recent story I think that we have come across here. So the update for Evelyn Alfred, now 64, or thereabouts, is that as of September 2025, Evelyn Alfred has secured stable housing, but her former shelter was destroyed in a fire. Legal advocates continue to monitor the situation, emphasizing the need for humane solutions to homelessness in Vallejo and beyond. But anyway, Robbie Powelson's story goes a bit like this. Two Vallejo lawsuits test legal protections for unhoused residents post-Grants Pass. And skipping through the story, in February, a VHU member, Vallejo Homeless Union member, Evelyn Alfred, obtained a preliminary injunction to halt the abatement of her encampment. Now a second case is underway. On June 27th, a group of encampment residents living near Vallejo's John F. Kennedy Library filed for a TRO, temporary restraining order, against the city, who had posted an eviction notice at the site the day before. Plaintiffs had also filed their case and application for a restraining order without the assistance of an attorney. The conflict traces back to May 22nd, when the city posted initial eviction notices at the library site. On May 27th, 5 days later, several residents submitted disability accommodation requests under the ADA, which requires public entities to make reasonable modifications unless the request imposes an undue burden or fundamentally alters a service or program. In general, ADA accommodations require dialogue between the parties to resolve the request, but in this case, the city did not engage in further communication. Sounds familiar. After a pause, the city reposted eviction notices on June 26th. The next day, four residents filed for a TRO, arguing that eviction would pose foreseeable risks to their health and safety under the state-created danger doctrine and would disproportionately affect individuals with disabilities in violation of the ADA. According to court filings, the residents of the library encampment have no viable shelter alternatives. One plaintiff, a mother with two children, cannot enter the local emergency shelter because minors are not permitted, and family shelters have no openings. Another plaintiff, a man with HIV/AIDS, cannot safely stay in congregate shelters due to the lack of airborne disease controls and testing. And the plaintiffs instead rely on the public library for bathrooms, water, and the level of safety afforded by the presence of security staff. In its opposition to the TRO, the city argued that it waited to act until a new shelter facility, the Vallejo Navigation Center, opened on June 23rd. However, the Navigation Center does not accept minors and lacks airborne disease precautions, rendering it an unsuitable shelter alternative for the plaintiffs. On June 27th, U.S. District Judge Daniel J. Calabretta issued a TRO blocking the city of Vallejo from evicting the plaintiffs from the library encampment. The TRO expired on July 25th after Judge Calabretta ruled against the plaintiff's motion for a preliminary injunction, but noted that the city must provide at least 72-hour notice before conducting a sweep of the location. Regardless of the lawsuit's outcomes, and especially following Grants Pass versus Johnson, the lawsuits in the Vallejo area highlight the ongoing role of courts in determining the boundaries of legal protections for unhoused people. The Supreme Court may have narrowed Eighth Amendment protections for those living unhoused, but other avenues remain under constitutional and statutory law. These two cases illustrate how local governments must still comply with the ADA and other constitutional rights when responding to homelessness, and demonstrate how unhoused individuals may continue to rely on the courts to assert those protections. Notably, these cases also demonstrate a growing trend in local court filings, unhoused people taking matters into their own hands. Both Vallejo lawsuits were initially filed without attorneys, which has successfully resulted in limited TROs against police raids on encampments. Vallejo's unhoused residents are not alone in taking up the task of filing court cases in defense of their rights. Lawsuits filed against the city of Berkeley have also postponed eviction operations at a number of encampments, and dozens of the city's unhoused residents have joined the Berkeley Homeless Union to organize in defense of their rights. And that was some selections from Robbie Powelson's August 6th article, Two Vallejo Lawsuits Test Legal Protections for Unhoused Residents, Post Grants Pass.
Charlie Kirk's in the news for taking his last breath in front of thousands who watched his death felled by an assassin of unknown creed who had the opportunity to do the deed. And the right's got a martyr to do what they will now that their man was killed. Charlie Kirk's in the news and the algorithm farms and every troll the world's up in arms, raking in the views, center, right, and left, leaving no tendency bereft of a portion of the harvest of rage that then prepares the next stage. Now the president's eager to tell us how they're gonna use this for inspiration to make America great again, or at least to show how it must be time to suspend democracy. Chuck in the news, and what's been sown will now be reaped like we've been shown. Our corporate overlords, whose songs we sing when they play the chords. However it goes, the reaper gets paid. Whoever wins, the money gets made. Charlie Kirk's in the news, it's one more step towards the Civil War. The one that's almost inevitable, or at least so very predictable. The algorithms he used to use so well that were the sword by which he fell. Because Charlie Kirk.
And that was Charlie Kirk by David Robix. So next up, I spoke with Steve Plaich, who is a, well, long-term fixture about Santa Cruz. I'm not as long as some, but quite a while, at least 20 years. I'd asked him to look into the M.H. Can situation because at one time he was the executive director, I believe, or something to that effect. I had a lot of criticism of how he, in my view, didn't as forcefully defend the group as I think he should have, but I'd hoped he'd have more information about the supposed, the group has been funded, but it's shut down. Why is that? And that's causing a lot of anguish and concern by people who have been using its services. It was established as a peer-run group to find other solutions for people in crisis than massive overdosing on medications, forced hospitalization, another standard. But often in the long term, not particularly effective means of treatment. At least many people have found that out. Others, well, are glad to have the variety of treatment. I certainly have found that to be the case among the people I've spoken with. Well, not much new did I learn, but at least on that MH Can situation, they apparently have not got back to Steve, but here's what he had to say when we spoke. It was Saturday, I guess, the day before today, if you are actually listening to this on Sunday the 28th.
I was talking to him about some other things, so I didn't really get a chance to talk to him about MH Can, although I assume he's still part of the group that's working on trying to, you know, reestablish those services. I'm guessing, you know. That's what my understanding was from talking to Susie O'Hara, who said that there was a group with Larry and some people from the city manager's office and Justin Cummings, and that was kind of the working group, from what I understand. So they haven't wanted to recruit me, so not surprising. You know, I mean, people think they know what they're doing, and, you know, they don't think anybody else does. So that's just the way that works with bureaucrats. Mm. You know, they don't really look outside their own sphere of influence to anybody who might arguably have some experience in the operation of that agency, which they clearly don't.
May I quote you on that?
And wouldn't have. Yeah, of course, yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, there's no reason why they would. They are not really engaged with that agency, and I'm not even certain they're really very much engaged with that. A population of unhoused folks who need mental behavioral health support.
So regarding the homeless person's legal assistance project, which I'm going to record you now, if you're okay with that. How's that going?
I've had two or three calls this week, but it's kind of things outside of our sphere of influence. I did have one person that seemed to have a housing eviction question that maybe we can help them with, but the other stuff was kind of somebody had a probate matter that the executor wasn't giving them copies of the will and things that are, you know, I mean, when I went to law school, of course you take what they call wills, trusts, and estates. That's where you learn all your probate law, but I never practiced probate law, so I don't know enough about it to really help. So all we can do is recommend that they try to contact a probate attorney. Unfortunately, most of these people, you know, are so poor, you have such limited means that they can't afford to hire somebody who's a specialist in that area and pay, you know, $300 an hour. And I don't know any practicing probate attorneys who would be willing to give anybody like a half an hour free consultation to kind of assess their case. So I wish I were more in touch with that resource, but things we do are really, you know, general and superficial.
As you know, people that are facing harassment from the police, now I guess they're turning to the camping ordinance. But in the past couple of years, they've been using other items like closed area, things like, the 13.018 section of the Parks and Rec's powers. You looked into that once about a decade ago. You were trying to do some cases on that. And also the idea that failure to pay should be a basis for finding someone guilty and then ultimately starting to issue warrants for them if they don't show up in court. But although I don't know if that happened much, but at least went to their credit rating.
It doesn't really impact guilt or innocence. You can't really find somebody guilty if they don't appear and have some determination by a court, and the court just can't by default say, well, you're not showing up or you didn't pay your fine, so you're guilty. That doesn't happen, but it does impact your credit rating. What we had looked at, and this is probably going back 10 years or so, is when they first had, that's the stay away ordinance, 13.08.020 or something like that. And I actually sued the city over that. We discovered that I didn't have standing to sue as a homeless person's legal assistance project because we weren't
a beneficent organization that offered benefits to our members. So you have to kind of be like a union or something like that. Then if you're an unincorporated association, you have standing. So anyway, the short answer was that we didn't have standing. So what I felt like, you know, they were using that to displace people out of public spaces. You know, I wrote a couple of different articles about that. And, you know, Indie Bay, Street Spirit, other places that you're familiar with, to try to get some awareness around that, because the police were, you know, for minor behavioral infractions, you know, you get a couple, and oh, you can't come into the park for a week. Oh, God, you can't come into the park for a month. Now it's 6 months. Now I heard up to a year. And the appeal process, as you know, I think we looked into that, and the appeal process was really within 10 days, you had to appeal to the city manager's office, but hardly anybody knew that or understood that. So the idea that there was notice of an opportunity to be heard, which is constitutionally guaranteed, was just really nonsense. It just didn't exist. But
plus the city,
I'm not aware that they're using that again.
Plus, honestly, the city manager was, you know, is a part of the whole process of.
Well, of course, and I do think, because I know the new city manager a little bit, Matt is probably a little bit more open to those
Matt
kinds of questions, yeah, than Martine Brunel was. So, you know, I mean, changing of the guard over there, and Matt's been on the job for 2 or 3 years now, so, but I wasn't aware that anybody was issuing stairway orders anymore, and I actually wasn't aware that the camping ban tickets were being issued.
Well, they're you being used as the basis for clearing campsites. I understand Cooper is currently in jail. I just got an email to that effect. You're familiar with Cooper?
Yeah, but I just saw Cooper downtown.
Oh, good.
Yesterday.
She's out of jail then. Maybe.
Yeah, yesterday. So, yeah. So she's around. She was sitting down in front of the Palomar with that whole group of folks, Joyful and his crew down there. So, you know, Gail Williamson and those folks. So, yeah, I did see her. She seemed lively and quick, as she always does, and said hello. And so I guess she's not incarcerated.
Did you join in the singing there, Steve?
Occasionally when I pass by, I do hum.
I try to be
on key, but, you know, I'm kind of waiting for you to join the group, and then I'll be more full-throated about my participation.
I see. Well, I have to think about that. What about the issue of which came up at the Board of Stupid Vipers, as I sometimes call them in my frustrated rage or just dissatisfaction, the idea of the abandoned vehicle changes that are likely to hit people living in their vehicles. You know, there's a meeting coming up on Tuesday. I can't find anything on their agenda. Not that I'm it's a long agenda. I may be missing.
Yeah, it is.
What's your sense? Have you heard scuttlebutt? As a man who has lived in his vehicle on occasion.
Yeah, I haven't heard anything about it. I do know that, all the Safe Spaces programs for the city are all just for oversized vehicles. So they are in reaction to the oversized vehicle ordinance, which we all fought against, and you so valiantly, in fact, at the Coastal Commission, the RTC, and all that stuff tried to beat that back, but without, you know, as much success as we might like. But so thank you for that.
So we beat it back for 5 years, but then they succeeded.
Yeah. But I haven't heard anything about, it's state law, that after 6 months, if your vehicle is not in compliance with registration, then it can be towed. It can be removed from the street. That's state law. That's not a local ordinance. So maybe they're just finally recognizing the fact that one of the tools that they have, you know, to clear abandoned vehicles that arguably would be abandoned because people couldn't get them registered because either they had smog problems or they couldn't afford to do it, which is often the case, or didn't get around to it. 6 months out of compliance is not a whole lot of time, honestly, when you're poor and, you know, you really can't figure out a way to mechanically get your car in compliance with the smog control regulations. So maybe they're just becoming aware of that. I don't know.
Well, I know you weren't, as I was aware, at the August meeting where they brought up this thing and tried to do a quick ram dam thank you sir deal and move it right on through. And the city official called in and said that what's his name? Who's the latest? The supervisor, Manu, I think his name is.
Manu Koenig. Yeah, I know Manu well.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he apparently hadn't done his homework, or his staff hadn't, or something, because his claim was that the program, the Tier 2 program, wasn't working because they decided it was a failure, and therefore he was very cynical about any kind of storage program, which of course is a way of...
Oh, brother, yeah, they can't.
I mean, it's not, we don't really have a storage program, so, but the fact is...
Is storage for people, for in-house folks' belongings?
No, I'm talking about storage...
For RVs, for abandoned RVs? Or?
Yeah, well, for people to park at night, not that are abandoned, but there were people want to get off the streets and not be harassed for being sleeping in their vehicle, which a number of people still do, probably a growing number of people.
Sure, they certainly do. One of the vast and growing demographics in any census and survey taken of houseless folks
What's your personal experience, Steve, in terms of the last few months? Do you find in your own, or maybe you don't even notice because you're indoors yourself a lot now, maybe, I don't know.
I'm not quite as much indoors as you might think, but that's a subject for another time.
Oh, okay.
As I'm moving around, I was shocked, in fact, over the Labor Day weekend, I haven't been driving around, to see how many vehicles are still parked, not on Delaware to the frontage road part of Natural Bridges, but down Swanton between where Delaware runs into Natural Bridges Park itself. There's tons of vehicles out there. Now, it used to be that they were all parked on Natural Bridges, as you know. And I think they came by and did some sort of enforcement on that. But there are a lot of people out parking at night. And I don't think it's possible, just in what the realm of law enforcement resources, to really do anything about that. Now, one other thing that impacts is the city stopped towing oversized vehicles and RVs of any kind because they didn't have a contract with a tow company that wanted to tow them. The tow companies don't want to tow RVs because when they tow them, they have to put them in the impound yard for a certain period of time. It takes up a ton of room in their impound yard, and then their salvage value is minimal and doesn't really balance out to the cost it for the towing and the storage. So they don't want them.
Yeah,
no towing company wants them. The last effective abandoned vehicle towing program or sweep was 3 or 4 or 5 years ago. Gosh, I think Rick Martinez was still deputy chief.
Now, where are you getting that information from, Steve?
Oh, this was from when I was with the Chiefs Advisory Commission, the committee, when Andy was still here, and then I hadn't been talked about much with Bernie. But anyway, they had done a sweep. They said that they took I don't know how many vehicles off the street, but they towed them up to Mio Lane, that dump site up there, the ref side refuse area. Do you know where that is?
I don't, but
just north of town. You go up past Western another mile or so, there's DeMio Lane, and that's one of the bigger, at least in North County, the bigger dump sites. They had a bunch of them out there.
Anything that you've noticed in the last, I mean, your involvement with this Chiefs Advisory Commission.
Oh, yeah, but I haven't been on the Chiefs Advisory now
did you speak with any people in your, because I know you're an ambulatory kind of guy, I'm not saying you aren't outdoors a lot. A champion walker, unlike some of us. There's more. I'm a champion.
Yeah.
Champion sitter. That's me.
But glad to be able to do it. Anyway.
Yeah. But I mean, the issue is: have you had much conversation about people and law enforcement's activities toward people as far as their accounts go? Any people come to you and say, "Hey, they went."
I haven't really. Not even anything anecdotal, honestly. I just really haven't. I know that, you know, I'm still getting calls because People First, Evan Morrison does the Santa Cruz Guide still.
Yep.
And I'm still listed in there. So I do get calls. I mean, honestly, I get calls. I'm going to try to respond as much as I possibly can. I mean, a lot of times I'm busy. I got this civil grand jury thing going on, and ACLU's ramping up. Today we're having our annual meeting, and I know you're disappointed, but once again, you are not an honoree. We did not decide to bestow upon you one of our Hammer of Justice, Bell of Freedom, Lifetime Achievement Awards. And
no, I'm waiting for that.
I have to apologize for that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I don't really want the hammer. I prefer the Boner of Justice, actually.
Oh, well, now, let me get back to you on that when we have our next board meeting, at any rate.
Now, where is
it? Honestly, in fact, I have to cut our conversation short because I'm going over to set up. We're at United Methodist Church, so we're having it today.
I have
to go over there and help set
Steve,
up.
I may give you a call after the meeting in order to get the update from there, and also I'd like to conclude a few things we're talking about.
I'll be available probably after maybe about 5 o'clock or so, 5, 6, something like that in the evening. I'll be available.
Sounds good.
Thank All right,
you.
Brother.
Hey,
talk to you later.
Take care.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.
I'm gonna tell y'all a tale that's been told to me a time or two. A thing you ought to do if you wanna be of good repute. You better go to a college, take out a loan, move on back in with your folks, cause you'll never own a home and work a couple of gigs that you don't need a degree to do. Deliver some food and live with the guilt that the misery you built on you. Time ago in a town far away, people told me if I wanna see a brighter day, then you better hit the books, boy, you better earn a degree. I never knew the whole country get the same damn trophy as me. Well, they're glad to take your money, glad to take your time, glad to put you all in debt before you ever earn a dime. You might make a connection if you can weather the haze. Shove you through like cattle, hand diplomas out like hay. There's a mutually agreed upon mediocrity between the teachers and the students and administrative faculty. You pretend to try, they'll pretend you earn the grade. But if everybody's here, how the hell are we all great? College is a racket, no matter how you stack it. Little tax bandits with a four-year plan. It's a lucrative endeavor sold with a moral component. The road to hell is paved with good intentions and good diplomas. Now when it's time to toss the hat, well, the trouble's just beginning. Cause you know there ain't a job and the loan won't be forgiven. What little you know now, you probably ought to forget. Well, you should have been a plumber, now you're dumber and deeper in debt. Can you really call it living without 40 grand around your neck? Now, if you want to be a doctor, if you want to build a bridge, better get the sheet of paper, better slap it on your fridge. But if you need to make a living, brother, don't make it hard. Get the Adderall prescription, get a YouTube subscription, a laptop, and a library card.
Yeah, that was Jesse Wells, College. Refreshing view, actually. And now some final messages before we hit the flashback, if you choose to listen to it. It's about 2.5-3 hours long, but frankly rather exciting for those who lived through those days and maybe instructive for those who didn't. We'll be talking about that in a moment. First, however, quick message that if you wish to reach the Santa Cruz Shitty Council, or City Council, as they call themselves, you can do that. And the way you do is you march on up to 809 Center Street, room 10, with 15 people preferably in tow, and attempt to make an appointment with Mayor Keeley or a council clone of your choice, and sit in the office until they agree to schedule a time to talk. They aren't required to, of course, but they are, in fact, your representatives, you know. Or they're somebody's representative, certainly the people, perhaps, who, more likely those who funded the most at the election campaigns, or the selection campaigns, as some might call them. You can also reach them by phone at 420-5020 or 831-420-5020-5020. And it goes to a message machine on the weekends. And that's also the same number to reach the city mangler or the city manager, Matt Huffaker, who's the real brains, brawn, and bullshit behind the operation here, the guy who has the power. If you want to call up and say, stop the sweeps now in Santa Cruz, stop funding genocide abroad as well as cruelty and futility at home, you can do that through calling that number. You can also reach the city council, theoretically, through contacting the city clerk, Bonnie Bush, although she's probably the best person to reach for Public Records Act. At least that's what I do. And thank you, Bonnie, for your assistance over the years when you've given it. Her email is bbush@santacruzca.gov. And that's the way to put in a Public Records Act request if you're trying to document abuses by the police department or get more information about those surveillance devices that are maybe strewn about Santa Cruz, or actually are strewn about Santa Cruz in various public places without the police department acknowledging and the city acknowledging ownership of those devices or use of those devices, which they should be doing. Not to mention the selective enforcement that goes on against poor people around town. Anyway, that's a good way to reach the Santa Cruz, at least to leave a message at the Santa Cruz City Council. If you're actually doing that, I would encourage you also to contact me. I'm Robert Norris, by email, rnorris3@hotmail.com, and send me a copy of you if you're emailing the City Council, which you can do. Each city council member has a separate email. So if you go to the Santa Cruz City website, you can get their emails and then just CC a copy so we can keep a record of your attempts and what doesn't just get lost in the great void. It probably gets lost anyway, candidly, but I'll have a record of it somewhere and I may be able to access it at a later time. As for the upcoming flashback, which is coming up, as you can imagine, this was largely discussed at this particular flashback was the last shitty council meeting of the year, which actually also was the topic of discussion on my previous show, which was a flashback to the December 13th, 1998 Bathrop Spears broadside show. There was some distortion in this particular flashback, so I excised some portions to save your ears. If you want to hear the original, you can actually go to the Huff website, go to the 1998 archives. That's under the archive of the oldest shows, and you can actually hear everything if you want to go through it. This has almost all of it, and it's some of it is very interesting. We were under warning by the FCC that they were coming to get us. They never did until 6 years later or so, but we were concerned and doing alerts. Linda LeMaster and Gaia or Lara Tucker, Lighthouse Linda as one was called, and I called her Tough Love Tucker at the time, discuss that. And I don't know if they field calls with me, but they're in studio guests. Then we also have